and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is October 15th, 2024, and this is episode 477. I am the co-host, Mark Ames. I am in Western New York. You are listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And I'm on the line with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, still down in New Zealand. How you doing, John?
Well, I'm pretty good. It's been an eventful couple of weeks here.
Yeah.
As some listeners may know, Catherine and I have been in New Zealand because Catherine's younger brother, Sean, had a terminal case of pancreatic cancer, and Sean died last week, and we had the first funeral, the cremation ceremony, in fact. And all I can say is that it was a grim ceremony, or it was a grim process, but Sean died with dignity, which I had thought was just a phrase, but he actually did it. And he died unafraid and actually trying to bring the family together, heal some of the inevitable rifts before his death, and make his death as comfortable for everyone else as he could, which I hadn't thought was possible. I've seen a few people die, and in Ashbery's phrase, they were suck screaming through old age and death, but not Sean. And that's really high praise.
Yeah, that is. It's scary, and also it's hard for me to imagine I could be anything like that, I have to be honest.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie. So that's really impressive of him. And but it does make it better on everybody else,
Yes.
It can anyway.
Yeah, it can.
I've
seen many deaths, and most of them, you have to say, are not like this. But
no, not at all.
Sean, I mean, there's that old cliche: nothing in his life became him as much as his death. But actually, Sean lived a good life, and he died a good death, which I think has to be rare. And now I suppose we can eventually leave New Zealand. We've been here for a long winter, which, you know, we came from the Northern Hemisphere winter just in time for the Southern Hemisphere winter. And we've spent the last 4 months in a ski resort, which luckily gets every Arctic blast that's going. So now we'll eventually be able to get back to sunnier climes.
But it's not too cold down in the boot heel, or is it?
Of Italy? In Italy?
Yeah.
When you're a short walk from the beach, it gets pretty damn cold.
Yeah, of course, because the breeze, and the wet air. Yeah. Even New York City, again, was like, New York City, as I've said, felt a lot colder than Rochester.
Wow.
Maybe I was out more, but I think a lot of it had to do with just the wet air from the ocean.
Yeah. Wet, cold air is no fun.
Yeah.
I also now have a raging case of asthma triggered by wet, cold air. So,
well, we've got a lot of pneumonia in my house. My wife had several days in a row of 102, 103 degrees fevers, and apparently it's going around, and then it turned into pneumonia, to double pneumonia.
Good God.
And apparently pneumonia is running around like wildfire in the Rochester area right now, which is kind of scary. I mean, I've known a couple of pretty young people who died of flus that turned to pneumonia, that turned into some weird death fast. Actually, it happened to this woman that I sort of knew, who was an agent for the first book, the Exile book that we wrote. And it just like happened like that, just out of the blue.
Wow.
And so, yeah, it can be scary. And my son had walking pneumonia. And so like our other son started hacking, and we just immediately took him to the doctor to have it checked, and but he's all right. So 'tis the season. But anyway, on a happier note, we have a great guest to talk with us about horses and warfare. And we thought it was a great way to just kind of step away for a moment from the incredibly depressing, wretched present tense and topical wars. Yeah. And we hope you appreciate it, because I think it's a great discussion with Carolyn.
It is. Rilligas. And she clears up some questions that I've really, really wondered about. They may be dumb questions, but I really wonder about them.
Yeah. War pedants pay particular attention here.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's get to our interview now with Carolyn Rilligas. Okay, we are really honored to have with us today a guest, Carolyn Rilligas. She is the author of The Horse in the Ancient World, From Bucephalus to the Hippodrome, also author of a book called Greek Warriors, Warfare Through the Ages. Carolyn is an assistant professor at Mount Royal University in Calgary, and she's honored us today joining Radio Warner. So first of all, thank you for coming on the show, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a huge honor, and I'm really excited to chat with both of you today.
Oh, great.
Yeah, we've had a lot of issues trying to imagine horses and chariots and their role in warfare, and I'm sure you can help us get a better idea of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely it's a rabbit hole to fall down. It's one of those things where we're all, I think, very cognizant of, you know, the importance of horse, of equids, but of horses in particular in warfare over the past, you know, several millennia. But you're just like, well, they're there. And then when you just try and grapple with the sort of nitty gritty of it and the nuts and bolts and the logistics and mechanics and all of that, it completely changes your perspective on everything having to do with really warfare up until, you know, World War II.
I mean, I've been in Calgary, and I know your Mount Royal is in Calgary. It must be great territory to imagine horse battle reenactments.
Well, and I actually get to do them, so it's even better.
Wow.
So yeah, it was very fortuitous that I ended up at the University of Calgary for grad school, and then getting a job at Mount Royal University, a few years after finishing my PhD, because this really is a pretty ideal place.
Do you have students who are good riders and are willing to be Scythians for a day?
So I haven't branched out into that at Mount Royal yet, though it would be a really cool thing to do in the future. And you obviously have to work with the risk management folks and the ethics folks and all of that. But back when I was still working on my PhD, we made some replica sarissas, which were the pikes that the Macedonian infantry used.
Wow.
Got approval, ethics approval and waivers and all of that. And so I had a bunch of students, and my graduate supervisor, my PhD supervisor, Dr. Waldemar Heckel, and my fellow grad student, Dr. Graham Wrightson, and a bunch of students and just members of the community and friends came out to the farm where I helped train jousting horses. And so my late great horse, Albert and I got to charge modified Sarissa phalanx, which was a really eye-opening experience.
Wow.
But I haven't, since finishing grad school and then getting this job at Mount Royal, I've been doing a lot of things sort of on my own and not so much sort of getting students involved, but certainly down the road, I think that would be really cool. Oh, I always bring replicas of armor, arms and armors to my Roman history class and my Greek history class.
Oh, great.
Which is going through lots of forms with security services, but we figured it out and it happens. And I now know that a spear fits inside a cross-country ski bag for transport purposes.
Wow, an old Roman on some spear. Flights.
So it's been an interesting experience.
Can you describe then what the old Macedonian pike was like how long was it, and then what did you learn, because you know you left us hanging.
So the Macedonian army under Philip II, so the father of Alexander the Great, so this is in the 4th century BCE, Philip really, I mean, we obviously, Alexander the Great's very famous, and he does a lot of things, and it's, he's an impressive general, but his father also did a lot of really impressive military things, and reforms, and sort of revolutionizing Greek warfare, and he often gets overlooked. So one of the things that Philip does, which becomes so instrumental in Alexander's success, is basically professionalizing the Macedonian army. So really creating one of the first sort of professional paid armies in the in the Greek world. I mean, yes, the Spartans were sort of career soldiers, but that was very different. Like these are, this is under Philip, you can make a career out of being a soldier, and not as a mercenary, but as like a soldier in the Macedonian army. And one of the ways he's able to do this is by finding a way to fund the army. So part of it is through territorial acquisitions. He gets gold and silver mines, but he also finds a way to arm infantry with kind of a minimal amount of equipment, of armor. So instead of the traditional sort of Greek heavy infantrymen, the hoplite with the big shield and the, you know, the cuirass and greaves and helmets and all of that, he sort of adapts this weapon that we call a sarissa. So it's a pike is one way to describe it. It's about 18 feet long. It's massive. And then it has a sort of a 1 foot spearhead on one end and then a 1 foot butt spike on the other end. So you can spin it around and still use it if the shaft gets broken. And so when you're carrying a weapon that's that long, and the sarissa phalanx is often compared to a hedgehog, which is really funny because I have hedgehogs and I can see that. But because you have so much of this weapon sticking out in front of you, you don't need to be heavily armed because the idea is nothing's going to get close to you. Like the front couple ranks might be, but if you're in the center of the back of the phalanx, you don't need a lot of heavy armor. And even things like arrows being shot at you are going to ricochet off this sort of hedgehog-like formation of sarissae. So it's been really cool. It was really cool sort of figuring out, one, how these really unwieldy weapons worked, because they do. You have to train to use them. And this is, we have accounts of Philip's, you know, having these professional soldiers and they're training and they're doing long marches with these and they're practicing with them because they are very awkward to move with. So what we were trying to figure out was there's a famous battle, the Battle of Gaugamela between Alexander the Great and King Darius of Persia, in which Darius sends in scythed chariots against Alexander's sarissa phalanx. And the sources say, or some of the sources say, that the soldiers were then able to step out of the way and create these laneways for the chariots to gallop through. And so they didn't have the effect that Darius had intended. So what we were trying to figure out is how easy or how feasible is it for even a small formation of sarissa bearers to move out of the way when, in my case, a horse, I didn't have a chariot. So when someone on horseback is sort of charging towards you without getting tangled up and stuff like that. And then also we were just curious to figure out, you know, how would a horse feel about going towards a sarissa phalanx? So learned a lot.
Horses, as you mentioned, I think, shy away from any large solid object. And it's hard to imagine a larger or more solid object than a phalanx with sarissae.
And so what I discovered, and the horse, Bert passed away a couple of years ago from sort of older age, but he wasn't, you know, a particularly brave horse. He was kind of just, you know, middle of the pack, probably closer to the bottom of the pecking order in terms of hierarchy and dominance in his herd. So, you know, you sort of expect, and what we've learned from working with the jousting horses and things like that is there are some horses that are just more dominant and aggressive, and they learn their job. And they're like, I will charge into that thing with my ears back, teeth out, and do it. And so it was really interesting working with Bert because that wasn't his personality. You know, he was considerably more timid. And so would he be willing to do it? And what we learned, and we do a lot of positive reinforcement, right? It's like you hit, you know, you bump against the person, you get a cookie or a carrot or something. If he could get his head and shoulders through a space, so like between two spears, or he would just keep going and he would just push through. And even going at a walk or a trot, the impetus was enough that, you know, where my knees would hit someone, it would just start to spin them out of the way.
You even mentioned that in your book, describing horses charging a phalanx, and that if there was even the slightest crevice that a horse could get through, and then it will charge through it.
They look
and
for that.
And it's related to your description of the physiology of the horse, that so much of the weight and musculature is and centered on the front feet.
Yeah.
So if you can push through with that.
Yeah. And horses also, I can't remember if I talked about this in the book or not, but they have very good vision. I mean, as a prey animal who lives in the prairies, they would need to, but they have a blind spot right in front of their nose. So once they're within really a couple of meters or so of, say, a formation, they'll see the soldiers further down the line, but anything that's directly in front of them, they don't see it anymore. So as long as they have the confidence and the momentum to be going forward, and the rider is reinforcing that, like, yes, we're going to keep going, and I'm not going to second guess this, then a trained horse will usually keep going.
Bert just needed that, you know, that opportunity to shine like an ancient cavalry hero, you know, and he got
it. And what really surprised me was, especially with the Sarissa phalanx, coming at it from the flank was actually far more difficult for him because that gave him the sense that there was coming at from the flanks on the side gave him the idea that there was a wall because he would see the ranks of Sarissas as a solid object.
Right.
So coming at it head on, he could see gaps. And coming at it from the side,
that's
because of the way you hold the Sarissa, it looked like it was this solid wall of people and pikes. And so he's like, I can't go through that.
Right.
Did ancient armies use, I don't know what they're called, but like horse shades over the eyes to
blinders.
Hide. Yeah.
So we do know in medieval Europe, there was a brief period in jousting tournaments. That's obviously, it's not the same as combat, but in certain jousts where they would cover the horse's face completely so the horse couldn't see. And so the horse would run down the list blind. And there's a couple of reasons for that. You know, you always hear, thankfully I've never had to experience this, but for example, if horses are stuck in a barn that's on fire, they will often panic for good reason. Mm. And so one of the ways to calm down a panicking horse is to blindfold them because then they don't have that sensory overload and they'll just follow you. So I don't think we have any evidence for actual battles being fought blind, but we do know certainly with chariot horses, they would, and just like horses that are driven in later periods, they do have blinders on or blinkers on. So they attach to the bridle and they don't completely cover the horse's eye, but they basically stop the horse from being able to see what's behind them. And the premise is they're not going to be spooked by the spinning wheels and things like that. And, you know, even with our horse armor, the chamfron or the chaffron, which is the face armor, does often have around the eye holes have sort of blinders or blinkers sort of built in to keep the horse focused on what's kind of in front of them and not on what's happening all around them.
Can we talk about chariots for a minute? Because speaking as a pedant who really knows nothing about horses, I got in an argument online with fellow pedants who don't know anything about horses, in which I said, I don't believe in chariots. I mean, how could a crude technology make a wheeled vehicle that could go anything other, that could cross anything other than the Bonneville salt flats? I just don't see it.
I mean, this is an inherent issue with chariotry. So when it comes to equids being used in war, horses aren't first. The first equids used in war are, we call them kungas. You can see them on the standard of Ur from ancient Mesopotamia. And they're probably a cross between a domestic donkey and a wild ass, like an onager. They are pulling these really unwieldy looking behemoths of chariots, like these big wooden carts that can carry three or four people. And obviously with something like that, the intention is not agility or speed. It's a mobile shooting platform from which to shoot your bows or throw your spears.
Right.
And then, you know, with horses, we shift to more agile chariots, which you see from certainly the Assyrians and the Egyptians. The Hittites tend to still have a bit of the heavier style chariot. And so it is really fascinating. I've had this argument with people before as well. And it was certainly something I wrestled with, you know, back when I was writing my master's thesis and then continuing on is, you know, why on earth would we drive horses before riding them? And I think when horses were domesticated, not I mean, they were domesticated for food, but then when we realized we could use them for other things, it logically makes a lot more sense that the first humans to use horses for mobility probably climbed on their back first, as opposed to being like, yeah, I'm going to harness you to something. And I mean, yes, we had ox carts, but we also rode donkeys and we also rode oxen and cattle. So in terms of just the sheer infrastructure of and equipment needed, jumping on a horse's back and putting a rope in their mouth or nothing, just a rope around their neck, or just riding them without anything on their heads to control them. You can see that just happening, you know, like a dare. Yeah. Some kid climbs on a horse and, you know, stays on and we keep doing it. But when it comes to warfare, the chariot seems to have, you know, kind of reigned supreme for a while. In part, I think because of status, they're expensive. And so it is a statement of the organization and the wealth of your society that you can produce these in all of the components, the wheels, the chariots, the harness, the yokes, the whole nine, and then have the number of horses you need, because you need at least two horses plus replacement horses and things like that. And then to be able to transport and move these things, I don't think it was ever about practicality, because there isn't much that's practical about chariot warfare. Okay, it was a blatant...
Did it have a psychological warfare effect? It
certainly would have had a psychological element. I mean, having that chariot thundering towards you is, you're going to, especially if there's a group of them, you're literally going to feel it through the earth. Certainly it means that you can have specific skill sets being used. So you would have the driver of the chariot, and then you would have one or two warriors in the chariot, depending on how big it was. So they would be focused on throwing their spears or firing their bows or swinging swords, whereas the driver then was focused on the steering of the horses. But certainly once we start to get to the types of chariots that we're seeing in Assyria and Egypt and Greece, like, these are not easy to stand in. Like, there's, you know, there's no shocks. It's not like now where, like, you know, you have shock absorbers. Like, you are basically, it's wood and metal.
You roll over a rock and what happens?
Yeah.
And we know, you know, by the time of the Battle of Gaugamela between Alexander the Great and Darius in the 4th century BCE, chariots are very anachronistic, and it's this weird thing that Darius brings them back, probably for a psychological thing. But he basically has to clear, he has to pick the battlefield, and he has to clear the battlefield for his people, clear the battlefield of rocks and obstacles.
Pebbles.
Because, I mean, any sizable rock.
Declare timeout?
Yeah, like, wait, stop, there's a boulder here. We can't go over it. And we know, we have accounts from the Assyrian kings who were very militaristic, of having to sort of dismantle their chariots to carry them over mountains and passes and things like that. And even, I mean, I have driven horses. I am by no means an expert at it. But it is very different. A lot of people who don't really know anything about it will say, oh, it's got to be safer, but it's not, because when you're on a horse, when you're sitting on a horse, you can feel everything that's happening underneath you. You can tell when the horse gets tense or if the horse is going to do something, and you can use your whole body to try and control it and mitigate that and rebalance. When you're driving, you just have your hands and your voice, right? Like, it's your connection to their mouth and your voice. I mean, you have a driving whip as well. But if those horses decide to go and explode and panic and bolt or whatever, there's nothing, it's incredibly dangerous. You have so few tools to be able to stop it. And then to be standing in the chariot, I had this, I remember having this thought. I was on a subway train coming home one day and standing on it. And I mean, even with those, I know when the stop is coming because the train starts to slow down and it's smooth. But still, your body rocks back and forth, and trying to keep your balance if you're not hanging on to something is really hard, which made me just think about, because this is what I do, think about how difficult would it be in a chariot with no shocks over uneven ground, where you're the warrior, not the driver. So you don't know where the driver's going or what the driver's doing, to keep your balance and then be fighting at the same time.
On the other hand, it made for some riveting scenes in those Cecil B. DeMille movies, you know, Charlton Heston.
I mean, it looks epic. It definitely does. So, and when we see the shift to mounted warfare, which happens sort of in the kind of early first millennium BCE, and again, the best evidence for it's coming from ancient Assyria, we actually see this really interesting, like, blending of techniques, where you'll have two Assyrian horsemen, right, riding into battle, and one of them is still acting like the driver. So he's got his horse's reins, and then he's holding his partner's horse's reins while the partner sits on his own horse and shoots his bow or throws his spear. So you see this like brief moment in the visual record where you can see they're trying to figure out how to switch it, and then obviously cavalry takes off and it's far more efficient and effective and mobile.
It would
and
make
agile
sense as a transitional stage. I mean, I find that easier to understand than chariots themselves, because the second horse, the one that's holding the bowman, can also read the landscape ahead of it and dodge obstacles.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's something like when they were first taming horses for fast riding and warfare, it must have been kind of scary because it's sort of like flying in an airplane or something. Like, you don't really control this beast. But if you're in a chariot, you feel like you have some control over your fate, even though it's completely illusory. I don't know. And maybe it gave the rider a little bit more sense of, you know, agency, as it were, or like control over things. And then they realize, well, that's actually not true at all. As they transition.
Or are you thinking that if things go, you know, truly south to shit, I can jump out of this thing?
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Exactly. That's what I would think of. Yeah.
But I mean, when you're on a horse and you're letting that horse just open up and gallop flat out, you know, you have, it's an incredibly exhilarating feeling. Mm-hmm. And for the first riders, it must have just been mind-blowing, because this really was the first rapid form of, it changed human history, and it changed how we moved and how we organized our societies and how we connected with one another, because it all of a sudden it opened up long distance travel in a way that had never existed before. And that brought both good and ill. But you still have these moments where you're on this on a horse and you're just letting it gallop. And no matter how well you know that horse, like in the back of your mind, and you try not to think about it, in the back of your mind, you're like, this could go really poorly. Like even if that horse just trips or steps in a hole in the ground or
decides, sudden, what is this thing on my back?
Yeah. You know? Sees some imaginary hobgoblin in the corner and panics. Right. It's prey animal. You're like, this could go very, very, very poorly.
I remember a Saki story about a horse that has a nickname like the Widowmaker or something. And they sort of keep track of what it's panicked about this week. And they say, he's taken a dislike to turkeys lately.
Yeah.
And apparently these things come and go.
Yeah. I mean, Alex, you know, Bucephalus, the horse of Alexander the Great, who's very, very, very famous horse. You know, the iconic story about him is that he was afraid of his shadow. And that's why, you know, when this horse is brought before Philip and his men at the Macedonian court at a horse fair, and he's extortionately expensive, like just obscenely expensive, but no one can get on him. And Philip basically says, piss off, you're wasting my time. And Alexander, who's, I don't know, 12 or 13 or whatever at the time, allegedly, you know, Plutarch tells this story, he pipes up and he's like, oh, you know, you're getting rid of the best horse here. And Philip says, but you think you can do what all of my trainers and experienced generals and all of these grown men who've worked with horses their entire life, what they can't do? And Alexander's like, yeah, I can. Like this sort of cocky, precocious kid. And what he's noticed is that the horse isn't being savage or violent or aggressive. He is afraid. He is seeing his shadow and spooking at it. And then when a horse is afraid of something, like even as irrational as it might be, the more you try and force them through it, the more they'll panic. And then they do revert to aggression because they're flight animals. And if you don't give them the ability to run away from the thing that they're afraid of, they will lash out. Like that's their, that's their second survival instinct, is to rear and bite and kick and bowl you over. And so he turns the horse into the sun so that he can't see his shadow anymore. And he jumps on and he just lets him basically gallop out, run out his anxiety, his fear. And then when the horse sort of breathes and goes, oh, okay, I'm not going to die. Then he turns the horse around, makes the horse look at his shadow and rides him back. And of course, it's this big story of Philip being like, oh my God, you need to get yourself a bigger kingdom. It's so, you know, it's this prophecy of you conquered this horse and you're going to conquer all this stuff or whatever. But for me, I've always been fascinated with that story because it shows this really fascinating understanding of horse behavior.
Yeah,
there's also the fact that Alexander was 12 at the time.
Yeah, 12
or 13. Which raises another question that I wanted to ask you, because seriously, we've had a lot of pedantic arguments, ignorant but pedantic, about the history of horses in war, of history and warfare. And one argument people use for chariots is horses weren't big enough yet.
Oh God! If you can see my face right now, Hollywood has a lot to answer for, but also just like, I don't know, especially I think North American sizestism. I say this as someone who lives in North America, where we have lots of big trucks, big dog. I mean, my dog's big. Lots of big things, big houses, big trucks, big spaces. This, yes, I mean, very much. We are often have had reinforced this notion that a horse has to be big, so tall and broad to be of any use. But when you actually look at the history of the domesticated horse and horse types, are big horses. So if you think of like Clydesdales, right, the Budweiser horses or your Percherons or, you know, often they say, oh, medieval knights rode these draft horses. The draft horses didn't exist yet. They did not ride draft horses. Big horses are really the result of the last 200 or 250 years. So from the time of the horse's domestication through the medieval period into the early modern period, you know, armored knights, the whole nine yards, they are not riding tall, massive horses. They're riding small, compact horses. And there's actually a study that the War Horse Project at Exeter University, which just finished, their publication's coming out in the spring, where they looked at medieval war horses in the British Isles and looked at the skeletal evidence, looked at the armor evidence, and basically determined that what horse historians have been arguing until we're blue in the face, that these were small horses. They, you know, 15.2 hands. So a hand is 4 inches. It's the basic unit of measurement. What we would now consider an average size horse. I mean, that would have been big. So size doesn't equal strength. In reality, the strongest horse in the world for size to weight ratio is the Shetland pony. These tiny little ponies from Scotland that, I mean, they can pull an adult male. People always put children on them. It's often a disaster. but so size has nothing to do with it. It's all about how the horse is built. So it's about the proportions of their body as opposed to the physical size. And big horses, having had big horses, they take longer to mature. They take longer to finish growing. They're more prone to joint issues. They need more food.
It all sounds like Great Danes. I've had Great Danes. And
that's a great comparison, right? The bigger they are, the more difficult they are to maintain and give a longevity of life. And I always point out that you had to be able to get on them, right? Like you had to be able to, like, you know, whether you're, if you're driving them, you had to be able to harness them. And when you watch people harnessing teams of draft horses, like they have ladders, like it is a process. And it's a lot of heavy equipment. And so the horses of the ancient world of the, like they're small. That is not a detriment. That is actually an advantage because they're more agile, they're hardier, they need less food. It is a very modern snobbery to think that horses have to be big to be athletic and powerful and strong and intimidating.
That's really good. Boy, I'm glad you explained that.
So the size had nothing to do with it. It was all about how the horses are built. And if you go, so I've been very fortunate to travel, to spend time with lots of horse cultures around the world. I've been to Mongolia and Kyrgyzstan and all sorts of places and been able to ride the local horse types. And they are always small. Right. And yet, I mean, tough as nails.
Yeah. And then a lot of Europeans seem to have reacted with amazement to the Mongol ponies, like those little pot-bellied things.
Yeah, and don't call them ponies. They get really mad if you call them ponies.
Oops.
But yeah, they're small horses. I mean, they're under 14.2 hands, and they are some of the, like, they're aesthetically, they are not the most beautiful, elegant-looking animals in the world. But they will just, I mean, the first day of real riding I did in Mongolia when I was a PhD student, I mean, we rode like 80 kilometers. I mean, those horses just keep going. Like they just go and go and go and go. And they have two speeds, walking and galloping.
Wow.
And they go over everything. Nothing like, And it was humbling, really, to realize that.
That gets us to the shadow of the Mongols. And I think whenever you talk about horse soldiers and horse archery, you have to talk about the Mongols, because certainly most of us have a memory of the Europeans' terror of them. And they supposedly rode these little horses and they used the compound bow.
Yep.
So, but I've always wondered, like, how did they use the compound bow? Was this a matter of clopping along out of spear range and then picking off people?
Yeah, so I do horse archery. I have a reconstruction of a Scythian bow, so one of the earliest types of horse bows. And it was
Scythian
the Mongol
bow.
Yeah, Scythian bow.
Cool.
Scythian compound bow. Or composite bow. And so I mean the Mongols don't invent this style of warfare. They just kind of perfect it. And the Mongol bow becomes a bit more powerful. So it's the same basic shape that all of these horse bows have, but they add these that we call them siyas on the ends of the bow. So it just makes the recurve more extreme, which then makes the bow more powerful. So these bows, I mean, they're quite small. They have to be, you're using them on a horse. I mean, you can shoot a long bow off a horse. There's a Robin Hood movie where they do, but it's clunky and awkward and not great. Mm. So these bows are perfectly designed to be wielded on horseback. And it's kind of genius. I mean, it's sort of up there with, you know, Philip coming up with the sarissa as a way to, with kind of minimal expense, create this army or this unit within the army that is incredibly effective. So when we think about horse archery, you're not, you know, aiming at specific targets per se. Like the premise is not I'm going to get on my horse with my bow and 1,000 of my mates and we're going to, you know, ride up to you and look at you face to face and get into close quarters and then shoot you with bows. That negates the whole purpose of having a bow. And this is, you see this in the classical tradition and sort of the Greek and Roman tradition. They're very conflicted about archery and whether it's a noble thing, a manly thing.
Yeah.
Or
in
not.
The Iliad, it's despicable.
Yeah. And they have this very conflicted element to sort of about it. But, you know, the basic premise of how mounted archery combat would work is you kind of, I often describe it as like a deranged merry-go-round, like this murderous merry-go-round of you're not going to go close to the infantry. You're not going to go close to your opponents. You just gallop in a circle around them and you just keep galloping and you drop your reins and you have your arrows and you just fire and you fire up into the air. You're not shooting directly at them. You shoot up into the air. So the arrows drop down into their formation and you just keep going. And then you go reload and refill your quivers and you come back. And if your opponents try to come near you, you just push your horses further away. And then they have this wonderful technique. I love it. The Parthian shot, which of course is the backward shot. So the Parthians were another one of these sort of nomadic horse archer groups come from sort of the Near East Central Asian grasslands. And it's genius. And you're on your horses. And so you do your crazy carousel of doom and firing arrows, and then you pretend to retreat. You turn your horses around and you go to gallop away. And as your opponents then kind of come out of their, you know, tortoise formation or whatever to march after you, you pivot your torso around and you start firing backwards over your horse's bum, which is actually where we get the term parting shot from, to deliver a parting shot. That is the Parthian shot, because you catch them by surprise. And so you're already galloping to safety. And you're still firing behind you quite successfully. And so you get away. And this is something you hear about over and over again with these horse archers. You know, the Greek historian Herodotus talks about the Scythians this way. He says, you know, they're the cleverest culture. Really.
Yes.
He's like, I don't respect them in other regards, but in this, they are the smartest culture because they are impossible to catch. If they don't want to fight you, you're never going to catch them because they don't build cities. They're nomads. Yeah. They just
There's
up
a
and
great
leave.
Quote. I have to read it from your book here. You write, when an exasperated Darius, that's the Persian king, sent a messenger to Adantherus, the Scythian king, belittling him for avoiding battle, because in Darius's world, that's a really bad thing. The Scythian king replied, quote, "This is my situation, Persian. I have never yet fled from anyone out of fear before, and I'm not fleeing from you now. What I have been doing is, in fact, no different from what I'm accustomed to do in times of peace. I will tell you why I do not engage you now. It is because we have neither towns nor cultivated land to worry about being captured or razed, which might induce us to engage you in battle sooner." So he's kind of just pointing out that the morality of leaving battle, whatever, is based on your economy, you know?
Yeah.
Then you develop a morality about it.
And then he goes on to say that if you want to provoke us, find the burial grounds of our kings. That we will defend. Otherwise, it's sort of, it's just endless grasslands. And we know these grasslands, you don't.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the mobile life. And so when you get down to the Mongols, I mean, they are part of this legacy of, yes, they have some more permanent settlements, and you find agriculture in parts of Central Asia, of course. There's different kinds of nomadism, but this notion of we basically just live on horseback and we move with the seasons. Everything that is of value, we carry with us. You know, we wear our gold as belt buckles and jewelry and things like that. So it's this just portable, powerful, effective lifestyle, and key to it. I mean, I say, oh yeah, you just shoot backwards off the horse. Like that is obviously a very difficult thing to do. It is a very disconcerting thing to do because your horse is galloping one way and you're always taught to look where your horse is going because they get that your head can help control where the horse goes because it weighs so much and it's on top of your body. And so having twisting around and then having your hips facing one way and your torso facing the other way and then firing this bow and again being like, please don't step in a hole and wipe out while we're doing this. It is a very difficult, difficult thing to do. The way your muscles have to work.
You must be so in sync with your horse, though. And so that comes from a lot of training and culture of training, I would imagine.
And that's why these nomadic groups, like the Scythians, like the Parthians, like the Mongols, I mean, they are literally raised on horseback. You know, when I was in Mongolia, you see kids who can barely walk yet, and they're just tied onto a horse, and off they go. Like an older sibling just drags them off across the steppe, and they're galloping along. And by the time they're 5 and 6 years old, they're riding in these Natum races that are 20, 25 kilometers long. So it's just, to them, it's just an intrinsic part of, it's like walking and breathing and drinking and sleeping. You just do it. You get on the horse and you go.
This causes me deep shame because I remember the couple of times I, like most suburban kids, was told, you're going to get to ride horses for somebody's birthday. And what I presume were like very old horses on their last legs would be led out. And you'd get on them and you'd walk along. And in my case, anyway, every time they broke into a trot, it was like, uh-oh.
I'm going to die now. Yeah. This is how it ends.
I had a different experience with horses. We lived sort of in when the South Bay was more rural when I first grew up in the South Bay area. And there was a horse stable, or whatever you'd call it, where you could just go ride horses. And my mother was sort of into it. So she actually, I think the first time was when I visited a grandmother of mine. We were out in Wisconsin. And then my mother would take us on horses, and I didn't feel any fear at all because I was so young. It just seemed natural. It's like, oh, cool, this is an animal. I get on it, and it can do things. And I was scared, I think, of a lot of things, but I really wasn't scared of the horse, and I don't know why, looking back. And as soon as they let me, I would take the horses, at least the ones in this place in the hills of Cupertino. I mean, I would get them galloping as fast as I could and in the hills around there. And I just never worried. And I was riding horses on and off whenever we could like afford it or something.
Yeah, but Mark, didn't you also jump off tall furniture whenever you could?
Did I? I don't know, maybe. But I think the last time I really rode horses was my first stepfather because he was like a hunter and an outdoorsman. And he got us horses for a one-week trip, camping trip in the Sierras. And all that time I was fine with him. And then I didn't touch a horse, see a horse, ride it. Life took a different direction. And out in Russia one day, I went somewhere where there were stables. I think it was outside of Moscow. And just did kind of like almost more like what John was talking about. It was really just trotting on some old horse in an enclosed area. It should have been safe as can be. And I looked at this thing and I was like, holy shit, this thing is huge. It's like, and it's muscle and it's got these intense eyes and it's looking at me like, who are you? And who do you think you are getting on me? And I got on and I was extreme, you know, I'm a big guy, but I was very intimidated by the horse because I understood it better. And I had a really bad ride, and the horse could tell I was nervous, and it just stopped. Yes. it just stopped to mess with me and to show that it had no respect for me. And I was like, you win. Like, get me off this damn horse now. You started when you were really young, right? And you never stopped.
Yeah, so I caught the bug, the horse mania. There's a Greek word for it, hippomania, mad love
right,
for horses.
Right, right, hippomania.
When I was about 7 or 8, I, apropos of nothing, like I was a suburban kid and I didn't come from a horsey family in any means, like any way, shape or form. And I just all of a sudden just had this profound moment one day. I seemed to recall I was like on an escalator in a department store with my parents and I just looked at them and said, I want to ride horses. And they're like, wow. Huh? What? No, no, she can't. No, no. And so I, you know, nagged them for about 10 years or not 10 years, 2 years. And then when I was 10, I got a package of riding lessons for my birthday at sort of the local stable, you know, through the city program. And I was not a brave child in any way, shape or form. Very timid, very cautious. And so I think they were convinced that she'll do this for, we'll do one 6 week right. or 10 week program and the spiders and the outhouses and the manure and just all of that. She's not going to like it. And they were really wrong because then I never stopped. Wow. And ended up studying it. And you know, it was never my plan. I was never like, oh, I'm going to study ancient horses. It all happened kind of serendipitously. And they were very smart, my parents. They never bought me a horse. They knew that that was a money pit that you do not escape from. Yeah. Which as a teenager, of course, I was like, ugh, this sucks.
Yeah.
Like, but it meant that I rode everything. Right. Any horse that I could get an extra ride on at the barn that I took lessons at, that, you know, I rode a lot of ex-racehorses, like off-the-track racehorses, which teaches you a whole lot. And that ultimately actually set me up for success because I had such a diverse set of experiences that when I started doing my research, which really just blew everything I thought I knew out of the water, I was not as unprepared for it. But yeah, I started riding when I was 10 and it's been 33 years and I haven't looked back or stopped.
This leads to the matter of horse culture and often cited the words for gentleman and the words for horseman are the same in many languages, but it kind of explains, I guess, things that don't make sense and seem mindlessly cruel like fox hunting, because I assume in fox hunting you're riding and you're jumping over fences. Mm-hmm. And I seem to think from those same Saki story, those same Edwardian stories that in a way I didn't understand until I read your book, that jumping over fences and avoiding holes and things is a big deal. And it would make sense if you were practicing for horse warfare.
Yeah. I mean, everything we do with horses, and certainly if you look at the three Olympic disciplines of dressage and show jumping and then three-day eventing, which is certainly, I mean, three-day eventing came out of the military.
Wait, could you describe what each of those are?
Yeah, so dressage is going to be the one that your listeners, if they Google it, they're going to be like, what is she talking about? She is on something. What does this have to do with warfare? Because when you see it as the modern sport, it really does. It looks very frou-frou. My dressage friends are going to beat me over the head for saying that, but it looks very elitist.
Yes.
It's kind of like ballet figure skating. It's dancing on a horse.
Right.
And you're in the arena and you wear the tail. They used to wear the top hats. They wear helmets now. But the tails and the you know, and it's, sometimes it's done to music. But so that's dressage. So think of it as horse dancing. And then show jumping is jumping the big colored massive jumps and trying to knock them down, knock the poles down.
Right.
And then 3 day eventing is a mixture. So you do dressage on day one. On day three, you do the show jumping. And then on day two, you do cross country jumping, which is galloping in the open across country through fields, hills, and jumping solid objects that don't fall down when you hit them.
Right.
And so it was sort of the ultimate training for the military horse because the dressage requires obedience and control. The show jumping requires athleticism and control because the jumps are so much bigger. And then the cross country is bravery and balance and boldness and this, you know, this ability for both horse and rider to get themselves out of sticky situations because of what you're doing and what you're jumping. So all three of these disciplines 100% come from the fact that few thousand years ago, humans had this utterly bonkers idea that we would climb on a prey animal that is afraid of its own shadow, which does happen. Sometimes runs away from the sound of its own fart. Like, they'll do that. They'll fart and then run away. They scare themselves with the sounds that they make. And we went, you know what we should do, guys and gals? We should get all sit on these horses and ride them into the most dangerous situations we can think of. So you had to come up with ways to train for it. So dressage, which looks the least militaristic and the most kind of poncy and elitist, dressage comes from the French word dresseur, which just means to train. And so dressage was the training of the warhorse to make them fit and balanced and obedient and strong. So all of the maneuvers that we now see in a dressage test, like an Olympic level dressage test, the what we call the piaf, which is the trotting on the spot, or the passage, which is this very slow, exaggerated trot, the pirouettes, which are exactly what they sound like. Mm-hmm. These were all maneuvers you would use in battle. Because when you're fighting, right, if you're in hand-to-hand combat with someone else on a horse or someone on the ground, you don't want your horse to just stop. You don't want the engine to stall out. You want the engine to keep moving. So you get the piaf, and they're trotting on the spot, and they still have that power. And then when you need to get out of there, they just shoot it off in whatever direction you point them, or the pirouette to spin around and catch someone behind you. And then you have what we call the airs above the ground. So you don't see this in competition, but you see this in sort of the famous schools, like the Spanish riding school in Vienna. And this is where the horse will leap up in the air and kick out, or rear up and sort of sink back on its hind legs and hold itself up in the air. You often see this position. It's called a levade. You see it on Greek tombstones and in Greek art all the time. And again, those are maneuvers that were created for war.
Was the horse, in some cases or in some cultures, trained to kick as an offensive weapon?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, and it's something that, again, horses, all of these things that we then trained the horse to do that looks can look like artifice or can look... you know, just like it involves so much control, all of it comes out of natural movements of a horse, right? So horses will kick out at one another, right? When they're in a herd and they're dealing with dominance or whatever, they will kick at one another. Or if you ride too close, you know, a red ribbon in a horse's tail means it's a kicker. So don't get too close to it if you're on a horse, because it will kick you, or it'll kick your horse. The
Good
prancing on the spot. Yes. Yeah, the prancing on the spot, the spinning around. When you watch horses playing and just being horses, these are all things that they do naturally. And then we figure out, okay, how do we teach a horse to do this when I'm sitting on it, when I ask for it? And people will say, well, if the horse rears up in front of you, you're just going to stab it in the belly. That's dumb. Okay, how brave are you that you're going to stand there in front of a rearing horse whose feet are kind of at your face now or above your head and be like, I'm going to hold my ground and stab this animal in the belly and hope it doesn't land on me, right? Like, I'm sure there are people who did. But when we see it transferred to the battlefield, it's not about the perfection and the precision that we see in the arena, whether it's in the Olympics or in one of these performances. It's about the power and the ability of the horse to do it. It may not look pretty, but it'll be effective, right? You're not being, it's like with the mounted archery. You're not being like, oh, I am aiming for this specific target as I gallop around those Romans. It's I am just galloping and firing my arrows, or my horse is just rearing up and kicking out because it's been trained to do this. And it's a almost like a symbiotic thing. It can sense what it needs to do, what I need it to do. And so things like hunting, jumping across country, this was all training for it, right? Get the horse out there and teach them balance, teach the rider balance. You don't fight battlefields in nice groomed arenas. You fight them out in the open. So there will be ditches. There will be walls. There will be holes and rocks and logs and dead bodies and all
death.
Sorts of things that you have to get over.
Right. Yeah, no, it makes so much more sense. And also the parading. I mean, you included a lot of great descriptions like from Herodotus and others. Parading makes so much more sense now as well, which now is just, again, more of a kind of, you know, seems like a little poncy sort of thing, parading with horses. But back then, that's how they got the horses used to actually going in formation and riding with each other and basically preparing for battle. And it was very practical.
You look at things like the RCMP, the musical ride with the Mounties in Canada. And yes, it is very controlled and it's to music now and it's in an arena and it's well rehearsed. But that ability to ride in formation and keep control over your horse and be aware of what everyone around you was doing, that all came back from using these animals in battle. And mm-hmm. I mean, I will say that the most terrifying thing I ever do on a horse is ride it in the Calgary Stampede Parade. Like, that is always just abjectly
what is it?
Terrifying. So the Calgary Stampede Parade, so the Calgary Stampede is the big rodeo we have in Calgary every July. It's been going on for over 100 years. Lots of controversy around it. That's a whole other rabbit hole that I will not jump into. But the parade, so I think it's the second longest parade in the world. I think only the Rose Bowl parade is longer. Mm-hmm. And it's at the start of the Stampede. And you have hundreds and hundreds of entries. So I've ridden in it both with the jousting group and then with one of the sort of light horse committee groups. And it is just terrifying because it's through downtown Calgary. So, you know, you're on these horses that you know very well, but you don't normally ride a horse in downtown.
Right.
And you, of course, have thousands of people just lining the streets and, you know, leaning out of the apartments and the office buildings and the parking garages. And you literally just ride your horse down the pavement into this wall of sound. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like one year we had the YMCA club right in front of us. And we heard the YMCA song all the time for like 4 hours. And like just the sound and the noise and everything is so so foreign to the horse and to what we normally do with them that you're like, this is actually abjectly terrifying.
Right.
Because also if something goes wrong, we are surrounded by thousands of people and we're on pavement and, you know, it's just,
a lot of things
it feels
can go wrong.
So artificial. And it's so, there's so much pressure that is very different from what you would normally do with a horse. So riding a horse in a parade, in a procession, and we know that this is something they did in antiquity. Again, it was part of desensitizing the horse and rider and also building that partnership between them. It's something that we often gloss over or don't think about or accept when we think about ancient cavalry or medieval cavalry or pre-modern cavalry is because, of course, horses died in battle, just like the humans did.
Right.
So we like to tell ourselves that they didn't care about the horses or that they were just another weapon. You know, modern cavalry is tanks. And so, tanks are machines. So clearly these soldiers just saw their horses as machines. And anyone who has ever worked with a horse and had to rely on that horse to keep them alive or to keep them safe knows that if you don't trust that animal implicitly and vice versa, if you don't have a partnership with them, then you're screwed. Like, you're not going to get anywhere.
That's another question I wanted to ask you because, we've talked a lot about late cavalry, like in the U.S. Civil War, where massacre of horses was just a given. But even then, there was still argument about whether saber or pistol was more effective. I think pistol won. But one of the questions that comes across from the deep bond between horse and rider and the issue of horse casualties is most of the time it seems like people were riding horses without any armor into battle. And that seems like a really expensive way of making war.
So when you think about nomadic mounted groups, mounted warriors like the Scythians or the Mongols, right, they didn't put armor on their horses or a lot of armor on their horses because it was a trade-off. Just like they themselves, you know, the Scythians certainly didn't wear a lot of heavily armed armor. They wore sort of leather scale armor, maybe metal scale armor, but they're not what we would call heavily protected because the whole premise was that you would never end up close enough to your enemy that you would need it, right? So the more armor you put on the horse, the more weight that is, and then the more that will affect the endurance and the agility and the speed of your horse. So it's, you can armor the horse, or what you're probably going to do if you're engaging in a lot of close combat and things like that, or you have less armor and you rely on mobility and agility to get you out of those sticky situations.
Yeah. But the love of your horse, I mean, you have this great epigram you quote from Hadrian to his favorite hunting horse.
Borysthenes, yeah.
Borysthenes, yeah. And it's really beautiful, actually. I didn't know Hadrian, whoever wrote it for Hadrian, was a poet. But reading it, it's like, you could just see your love for your dog or your cat in it, you know. Borysthenes the Alan was mighty. Does that mean it was an Alanian horse?
Probably, Borysthenes
the Alan.
Yeah, he probably came from that region.
Right. Was mighty Caesar's steed, or marshland and o'er level, or Tuscan hills with speed? He used to fly, and never could any rushing boar amid Pannonian boar hunt make bold his flank to gore with sharp tusk, whitely gleaming, the foam from off his lips, as oft may chance, would sprinkle his tail e'en to the tips. But he in youthful vigor, his limbs unsapped by toil, on his own day extinguished, here lies beneath the soil. That was a nice epigram to obviously much loved horse.
I think part of what we wrestle with is because of the sheer casualties that would have happened. I sort of use the royal we here. Certainly we as modern horse people, kind of looking back on the horse in the sort of the pre-industrial era. I mean, now, yes, horses still exist. Cavalry still exists in militaries around the world, and still will have active roles doing different things. You know, thinking about the Americans when they were in Afghanistan, and they did have mounted units that were used for transport and communication and things like that. But sort of using a horse in battle, you know, to charge, you know, that kind of ended in World War II, because fair, charging tanks and machine guns is not a great idea. Kind of spelled the end of that. And so part of it, I think we have this snobbery or this I don't know, almost saintly attitude of looking back on putting horses at risk to that level and being like, well, clearly they didn't care about them because, you know, I would never do that. And certainly my horse is my family. I love him. Like he is wonderful. I've always loved my horses deeply, but we're also very fortunate to not have to find ourselves in that position, right? When I got on a horse with a sword or armor or whatever to do a demo or to work on my research, it's a decision I'm making. We do it in as safe an environment as we can. I mean, with horses, things always can go wrong. I mean, accidents can always happen, even just, you know, leading a horse through a field, things can go wrong. But, you know, we can exert so much control over it and make it as safe as possible. And the idea of why would I risk this animal in battle, I think that really kind of speaks to privilege. We don't have to.
Yes. Yeah.
We can own a horse. We can have horses for the sake of having a horse for what it is and love them and appreciate them for that. They can be expensive, ornamental lawnmowers, which they are for a lot of people. And it's really hard to put ourselves in the mentality of, well, I have this animal that is expensive, that I have invested a lot of time and money and effort and emotion and blood, sweat, and tears into because it's my war horse. And I'm a soldier, I'm a knight, or I'm a horse archer, or I'm a Greek cavalryman, whatever, what have you. And now I have to ride it into war. With the recognition that we could both die. And I think that actually takes a tremendous bond because as Mark, as you were saying earlier, you know, when you're riding that horse in Russia and it could sense that you were uncertain and it was like, screw you, I'm just not going to move. If I get on my horse, like we're going off to war now and I am uncertain, I am anxious and I let those feelings take over.
They can sense it.
They're prey animals. They can tell when we're afraid. They can tell when we're full of crap. They can tell when we're being arrogant and hubristic, and they will respond to it. So it has to be this, okay, I trust you implicitly. You trust me implicitly. We're going into a very high stakes, stressful situation, but we've trained, we've practiced, we've built a bond, and we do that through doing parades, through hunting, through riding out, through practicing all the time. And now we're putting it to the test. And I don't want anything to happen to you, but, you know, I'm going to do my best to keep you safe and vice versa. And in reality, obviously the invention of gunfire on the battlefield changes things, but kind of pre-gunfire, it's not really for the opposing side, it's to their advantage to not kill your horses, because then you take trained war horses when you win. Right, we have loads of inscriptions from the Assyrian kings in sort of the second, first millennium BCE.
They're so valuable.
I won this battle and I took this many teams of chariot horses and this many chariots, because that is a huge investment. It's like taking the military intel from your opponents and like getting full access to it. So yes, of course horses died or were seriously injured, but you're better off trying to keep them alive and then take them as spoils of war than you are to massacre them.
I mean, people need to understand, I think, or this book helped me understand that horses for humans or a technology, but a live technology, but just like one of the greatest technological advances, like the wheel, basically. And they kind of went together to a degree until trains and then cars. And trains, of course, were weren't they called like iron horses?
And cars have horsepower.
Yeah, horsepower. And basically, trains and cars are just like robot horses, you know, in a sense. And you have this incredible description of how a horse's respiratory system is into, and it sounds so much like an advanced, you know, just such a really cool, I mean, machine. I hate to say it because it's also a living animal, which makes it all the more
incredible. Well, I mean, that's
incredible.
What one of the most famous racehorses of all time, Secretariat, the great Triple Crown winner, who was, you know, when he was, I think it was in, it must have been in the Belmont, the third race in the Triple Crown, and he won by, and it's like 36 lengths. Like, it was ridiculous. And the announcer describes him as an incredible machine, just the way he is running. Like, it is perfection. Right. It does not look stressed, distressed, tired. Like, he just kept going faster and faster and faster. But it was beauty and harmony and his jockey perched up there and controlling all of this mass and this strength. And he was described as like this great running machine. So, I mean, it is an apt, certainly an apt description, because we try and describe things based on what we know. And so the precision and power of machine, I mean, that's what that you saw in the living flesh and blood of Secretariat in that moment.
You have this description here. When a horse's front legs strike the ground at the gallop, the ribs are forced upward, squeezing air out of the lungs. At the same time, the horse lowers his neck and head, pressing the rib cage backwards. The front end of the body is losing momentum at the point in the gallop, at this point in the gallop cycle, causing the internal organs attached to the diaphragm to slide forward, further pressing on the lungs. As the horse raises his head and neck, the load is removed from the forehand and the rib cage and sternum are pulled forward and down. The forehand accelerates again and the internal organs slide backwards, causing the lungs to expand and draw air in. I mean, it's amazing.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's a bellows machine, right? If you think of a bellows to use in a forge, but it's just the natural power of the horse. I mean, this is an animal, this is a species that, as it evolved into the form of the horse that we know, right, even when it was still wild, before it was domesticated, everything about it is perfectly, beautifully designed to run, right? To live as a large prey animal in open grassy spaces where there's nowhere to hide, and to just be able to run faster or further than anything that might try and kill it, and just go. And it is poetry in motion. I mean, whether you're looking at tough little Mongol horses or a thoroughbred racehorse, like, to watch them, especially in a herd, to watch them just run, it is one of the most sort of goosebump spectacular things to see, because of the power and the way that their body is really engineered to be able to do this.
Yeah, you have
just there's nostalgia for that comes up in weird places, like Danny Boyle's film 30 Days Later is a zombie movie. But really, one of the most memorable.
Days later.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
28. You know, I'm rounding it off. one of the most memorable scenes in the movie has really nothing to do with the plot, or at least not directly. It's just now that England has been depopulated, they see horses running in an open field, and there's nothing to contain them anymore. And the characters say how beautiful this is. I mean, it's the product of depopulation, of devastation, but it's almost like a folk memory of, God, we used to have open landscapes where the horses could really run.
Well, and I mean, think of how frequently the horse is used as a logo. You know, whether you're talking about something like Ferrari, which is a very obvious thing. But the horse is a logo, is a symbol, you know, luxury brands like Burberry or Hermes, which started off as a saddle maker, Ralph Lauren, Gucci with the bit. Like, the horse is this.
Ah, that's a this, bit.
Yeah, it's a
okay,
bit.
Okay, now I know.
Yeah, snaffle bit. It's this, you know, in Burberry for a long time, their logo was a knight, right? With the Latin motto on the banner. And yes, there's the elitism and stuff connected to that, but also just, the horse is such an instantly recognizable animal. You know, even if you've never, if you've lived in an urban environment and you have never come face to face with a horse or touched a real horse before in your life, you know what they are. And there is this sort of profound desire that we have for them, in the sense that they do give you a freedom. You know, even when you live in a city and you then get out and you go for a ride, whether it's your own horse or you go for a trail ride or something, there's this freeing nature of it, that now you're on this animal that is moving you, and you have to find a way to meld your body with theirs, you know, a quadruped and a biped, a predator and a prey animal, and find a common language. And the horse makes you shut all that busyness off, right? If I go out and I go to ride a horse or work with my young horse or whatever, and I'm thinking about, oh, I've got this meeting and I've got to write this chapter and I've got to do this and I've got to do that, and I only have 20 minutes or 30 minutes to get this exercise or this training session in, it'll be a disaster, because they're like, you're not paying attention, you're not committed, like, no.
Yeah.
And bringing that back to warfare, again, it's thinking about when I put on my armor and get on my horse and put on all the military equipment, it's like switching into this mindset of, this is what we're going to do now. Right. And everything else you can't think about. You just have to be focused on you and your horse and the language, the shared language that you've created between one another.
One more thing and then we'll let you go. This has been great, though. I really appreciate this a lot. It's wonderful.
Like, we don't do in a lot of long-term problems.
Yeah. in pedantry fights, yeah. But also, we don't do much hardware, and sometimes people get a little annoyed. Like, John and I don't do a lot of hardware store, and this is hardware. I mean, kind of the ultimate hardware story, and it's great. And your book gets into cataphractic. Your book has some great descriptions of cataphract like battles and stuff. But I think one thing I just wanted to ask you about has to do with something we've kind of observed in the show in different episodes, that the Romans, basically kind of the Europeans, but certainly in the ancient days, so the Romans, the Greeks, none of them were much into cavalry. They it was sort of a side thing for them, you know, to protect the flanks or something, but they weren't big on cavalry. I guess Alexander the Great maybe was the one exception that I got from your book. But what your book does a great job of doing, starting with kind of, you know, the evolution of pre-horses, you know, 55 million years ago, then going into the different types of horses and where they are, where they were, let's say 5,000, 10,000 years ago, and how the environments kind of created essentially sort of four different types of horses. And so if I understood it right, I mean, one of the reasons why is that the horse that was more common in that part of the Mediterranean horse, was not really suited for a lot of the, I mean, it was a tough horse and great for sort of like mountain, I don't know, rocky terrain, but it was not really suited for the sort of cavalry warfare, unlike some of the Central Asian and Near Eastern horses. Is that right?
It's not so much that it wasn't suited. I mean, you can make any type of horse suited to military things. You just have to find the right tactics for it and use it sort of based on, basically what I argue is that they were basing their military tactics and their cavalry tactics and equipment on the horses that their environment had created, instead of trying to force. They're not selectively breeding to create new types of horses. This is what we have, so this is why we fight this way. The primary sort of barrier that you're kind of finding in, you know, the Italian peninsula and then the Greek peninsula, when we sort of talk about Greece and Rome, because then obviously you get the outlying areas, but sort of Rome proper and kind of mainland Greece is the geography and the topography. You know, mainland Greece, for example, is 4/5 mountains. And while there are some incredible mountain horses out there, that's not the ideal for breeding horses on a large scale.
Right.
You get a couple of regions like Thessaly in central Greece and then Macedonia in northern Greece, where you have these open, more grassy areas where you can breed on a larger scale. Just like in Italy, you have sort of ancient Etruria, so modern day Tuscany, but by and large, it's a lot of mountains. And so when you think about the sheer number of horses you would need for cavalry, even just the basic numbers of like each cavalryman would need two horses, right? Like two trained war horses. They're regular, like one horse and a remount. especially if you're going on campaign, right? That you're not going to, the horse you're riding and then ride it into battle and then ride it again. Like, you're going to want to switch it out. And if they get injured or sick, or because they're prone to all of that stuff.
Right.
So it's having the space and the resources to breed horses on a large scale. And you have that ability in Central Asia, in the Near East. I mean, you have perfect territory for large-scale breeding of horses, which is why that they're able to field so much more cavalry and use them sort of more directly to influence battles. Whereas in Greece or sort of the Italian peninsula, it's part of it is the cost. It, you know, I've spent all of this money because of my social economic status, you know, where I fit into society. I'm expected to be a cavalryman. So I am spending a lot of money on buying this horse, training this horse, the equipment for the horse.
Yeah,
it's a flex. And then when I ride it into battle, how much do I really want to risk it? Like, knowing that there is that risk. So what you tend
to see... Don't scratch my Ferrari here, man.
Yeah. Like, I mean, so what you tend to see in the Greek world pre-Alexander is cavalry very much being used for skirmishing, for harassing. And they're perfect for that. Like, they're always perfect for that, right? They can, you know, gallop down, throw spears, and then wheel away. They can taunt you when you're out foraging. They can run you down. I mean, Xenophon, who is a Greek author, is from Athens, you know, and he actually writes a text called The Art of Horsemanship, which is a foundational text. It's incredible. It's still very accurate 2,400 years later.
Yeah.
But in one of his other works, The Anabasis, you know, The March of the 10,000, and they're in Persia, as mercenaries, these Greeks, and they find themselves stranded and they don't have any horses. And he's basically like, we're hooped. If we don't get horses, if we don't have horses, if we lose, we can't get away. They'll catch us because the Persians have horses. And if they lose, we can't catch them because they have horses. Like, we need to have horses. Being on foot is going to be a disadvantage in this space. So it's, it comes back to that notion of types of horse culture and access to the resources for what we call hippotrophia, so horse breeding, horse rearing. And you need space, right? You need grass. You need time to let these horses mature. It's a slow process.
The Tang Empire, from a very urbanized or intensively agricultural river basin, basically, seems to have had a love-hate relationship with Tatar areas of Central Asia, purely based on horses, right? Like every year they had to either make a deal or go on an expedition, military expedition, against the Tatar areas that would breed horses, because you couldn't breed horses enough for your army on the rice fields.
No. And I think there's, you know, there's a story going back to one of the first emperors of China. I think it's like in the second century BC or BCE or something like that. One of the English names from is Wu Tin. And there's these famous iconic horses from the Fergana Valley. They're called the blood sweating horses or the heavenly horses. And they sort of recognize that, again, because of the constant threat from the steppe of these horse people, like, you know, we need better horses, or we need to have a more sort of established cavalry so that we can defend ourselves. But we need to have some sort of one up on them. So the idea was they would import these very sort of unusual, expensive, interesting horses from Fergana and cross them with their local horses and create something that was a better war horse. And of course, the people of Fergana were like, no, you can't have our horses. I don't care how much silk you offer us. We're not going to give you our horses. And so he waged war to get them and did get some ultimately. But again, it speaks to thinking of the horse as technology, which is always a very difficult thing for me to do, how much you need it. And we see this, you know, the horse is an introduced species in most of the world, right? You know, and they're introduced through conquest, through colonization, through trade. I mean, but now you find them everywhere except Antarctica, right? Mm-hmm. Every other continent country, from Siberia to Patagonia to South Africa, you know, Australia, New Zealand, like horses have, you know, they've been introduced everywhere. And they are always, this is one of the things that fascinates me. Although they often come in as representations of violence and conquest and sort of cultural destruction, the local cultures, the indigenous cultures, the communities that are there, they see the horse and they go, we need that.
Yep.
And they weave it into their societies and they make it part of their cultural identity. And they build traditions around it. They build sports and festivals. And it's just such a fascinating thing. Like I don't think there's anything else that is like that, where it's like this animal. And it is so foreign to the landscape and to the practices and pastimes and of these cultures. And they're like, nope, now it is part of us.
Yeah.
We need this.
Well, I mean, I think this extends to some very weird dimensions. Like there's a strong taboo against interspecies mating in, as far as I know, every human society. But there's also this tradition that the Irish kings, you know, did or did not mate with horses. I mean, and that's
And there was, I think, Vedic, ancient in India, there were rituals that had to do with that too. And they sort of absorb in the power of the horse. The whole Indo-European thing. That's a whole other crazy rabbit hole to fall down.
Yeah, well, again, the Indo-Europeans, wherever they were, whatever landscape they went to, they got weird about horses, that's for sure.
And they brought those horses with them. I'm like, we need these horses. And they're just, they become such a part of the cultural fabric. And, you know, today, living in the global north or, you know, Europe or North America or whatever, where we don't need horses for industry and we don't need horses for war and we don't need horses for transportation and to survive on a day-to-day basis. You know, a lot of people thought that the Industrial Revolution and the mechanization of warfare and agriculture and transportation was going to be a death knell for the horse. Mm-hmm. And there's more horses on the planet now than there ever have been.
Wow. Right? Oh, wow.
I don't know. I don't know, living case study for it, where my family has no long-standing connection with this species. And yet I just one day went that. I want to be part of that. I want to love that and engage with that and have them as part of my life. And there's just something so powerfully poignant about horses. And I think because they have been woven into our cultural fabric in so many ways, so many of the phrases that we use and concepts we have are throwbacks to when we did rely on horses, that it's impossible to imagine not having them. And then this huge privilege of being able to spend time with them and engage with them. And the power they have now is therapy animals, right? For veterans, for people with physical disabilities, with, you know, there's just so much that they're still giving us. Quite selflessly, I think. I know that sounds really cheesy and romanticized, but even them letting us ride them to war, because they did let us. You can't make a horse do anything
it does not want to do. I mean, it's like the closest thing to a miracle that a horse could be trained to ride into war, a prey animal, you know, that is
this. And do it more than once. Yeah. You would use them again. Yeah. It's not like, oh, this is a one-off and I tricked them into doing it and now they're never going to let me near them again.
In fact, there's that biblical verse, isn't there, like about a war horse that gets happily excited at the sound of the trumpet.
Yeah, very, very, very famous passage about how the horse just gets so hyped up when it hears the sounds of war. And it's like, this is my job and this is what I do and I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why humans do this, but this is what we do.
It's amazing that you took your love of horses and mixed it with war. I'm assuming you have an interest in war, or is it because of horses? And
I call myself very much the accidental military historian.
Okay.
it's not what I had intended to study at all when I started graduate school, when I started my master's degree. I was going to do a master's in Alexander the Great, but I was going to look at his religious propaganda. Mm. And my supervisor hates that topic. He's like, no, you're not. Like, I just moved across the country to get accepted into this program. What do I do now? And so he was the one who tipped me on this path and said, well, why don't you write about Macedonian cavalry? You're a horse person.
Right.
I was like, I don't know anything about warfare. I generally abhor violence. I can't watch like post-World War I movies. Pre-World War I is fine, but like post-World War I, my brain can't handle it. I can't watch Saving Private Ryan. I would never sleep again. I don't know what it is.
While we're on the movie topic, is there a movie that you can recall that does a particularly good job of depicting mounted archers or medieval cavalry in general?
So it's a tough one because Hollywood always sort of has its own take on cavalry charges. And I have learned to accept that part of this is just, it's the stunt horses that they have access to. So often the horses you see being used in these films are not horses, types of horses that would have existed at that time, like the big Frisian horses, the big black horses.
Right.
But I will say Kingdom of Heaven, the scenes where you have the Muslim cavalry, they do appear to be mounted on fairly sort of appropriate horses, sort of the Barb horses and the Arab horses. I'm trying to think of a movie that has sort of well-executed mounted archery. And I think the very fact that it's hard to think of one sort of also speaks to, we tend to think of cavalry as being sort of the very European style of cavalry with the knights and the charging and all of that. Right. But there was a movie that came out in, I think it was 2007 or so, about Genghis Khan and the Mongols. I haven't watched it in a long time. I remember it being quite a good film, but whether it had great scenes of mounted combat and horse archery, I'm not sure. And then there was, I think it was an HBO series or something, or a Netflix series that, again, was based in the court of Kublai Khan, and it was Marco Polo. I think it was called Marco Polo, and there was a couple seasons that came out. And they had some pretty cool horse stuff, some pretty accurate or impressive-looking horse stuff in that series as well. But you don't often, in Western film anyways, see a lot of horse archery. And I think that's just this ongoing tradition that goes all the way back to the Greeks and the Romans of being like, oh, archery, it's not real warfare. You got to get up there in your heavy armor and, you know, hand-to-hand combat for it to be legit, which of course is slightly ridiculous.
And then when you're on a horse, you're cheating twice over.
Right?
It's no fair at all.
Look at me on my horse. You can't get me.
Yeah.
I think this is a good place to end the interview, and it's been great. I'm really so glad that we got you on the show,
Carolyn. Well, it's been an absolute joy to talk about this, and there's so much more I could talk about.
I know. Again,
we'll have to have you back.
Yeah, yes. I'd love to.
Yeah, you said you're working on a book about Alexander the Great or something?
Yeah, so Alexander, the story of Alexander and Bucephalus. So it is really, Bucephalus is a very famous horse.
Right.
You know, Alexander names a city after him when Bucephalus dies, Bucephalia in the Punjab. At one point, Bucephalus is stolen by bandits when they're somewhere in Afghanistan or somewhere in Central Asia. And he basically says, I will end you. I will burn all of your villages to the ground if you don't give me my horse back. Like,
ever been the victim of a pickpocket would just totally understand.
End you if you don't give me my horse back. And in the medieval period, in the Alexander romances, this whole manuscript tradition, Bucephalus just becomes this like just crazy, this wild hybrid character that melds like the idea of a unicorn and sort of Christian theology and then with the stories of Bucephalus and all of it together. And then he goes on to inspire modern ideas. So there's a really famous young adult series by Walter Farley, The Black Stallion, right?
It's an
iconic novel. And then there was the film with Mickey Rooney that came out.
Right.
And in the opening of the film, the dad is telling the story of Alexander and Bucephalus. And then it was like, I had this years ago, I had this like, holy shit moment. And I'm like, yeah, because the kid is named Alec and the horse is just called the Black. And the horse can't be tamed by anyone except Alec. And then they go on and you have all these adventures together. And it's like, it's Alexander and Bucephalus. Of course it's Alexander and Bucephalus. Right. And you get all sorts of, you know, later generals who have to have like the horse, you know, whether it's El Cid in Babieca the Duke of Wellington in Copenhagen or, you know, Napoleon in quote unquote Marengo, who was never a single real horse. There was no Marengo. There was no evidence of a Marengo. But this idea that he had to have
like
the horse.
Like Lassie.
Yeah, exactly. That to be this great general or this great king or this great ruler, you have to have the horse. And so I'm kind of starting in antiquity and sort of exploring this concept sort of down into the sort of modern reception.
And if you want to write another book that I would definitely root for, it would be Chariots Are Dumb.
Chariots Are Dumb and Other Bad Inventions.
Yeah. All right, great. Well,
done.
Okay.
All right. Thank you again so much, Carolyn. And like I said, we look forward to your next book and we'd love to have you on again.
Perfect.
Carolyn Willekes, and we'll post links to her book, The Horse in the Ancient World, From Bucephalus to the Hippodrome. Thank you again, and talk to you soon.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I think we can end the episode here. Thanks, everyone, for supporting the show.
Thanks everybody.
To Carolyn and Brendan and everyone. All right. Talk to you soon. Bye.